Now we're back in Ecclesiastes, and we're going to read from chapter 5 and verse 8. It says this: if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, so shall he go again. Naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, say that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is a vanity, it is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good. Do not all go to the one place. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for a man while he lives the few days of his life, his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? Do keep that open. And on the inside of your sheet, there's some points which will be a help as we look at that passage together. Greed is good. Greed is right. Greed works. There's a few puzzled and slightly worried faces. Some of us will know that that is a quote from the Michael Douglas character, Gordon Gekko, in the iconic 80s movie Wall Street. And if you know the film, it's part of a speech in which he argues that greed is a really useful motivator, and it ensures individuals and companies and even the economy at large succeed. And after the film, it became something of a 1980s slogan for some people, greed is good. I guess for lots of us in this room, we probably wouldn't express it quite like that, quite that bluntly. But we do live in a society, don't we, that just assumes that the good life, the best way to live, is comprised of ever-increasing material possessions, and therefore that discontent with our current standard of living is just a normal and expected part of life. So technology keeps offering us new, wonderful possibilities, and then advertising keeps dangling the next thing and the next thing just in front of our noses. And so we as a society have bought into this universal expectation of more, that what we need is more and more and more. And our writer Solomon, who we just read his words there, he is asking us to take a cold, hard look at some of our assumptions behind our lives, and he's going to show us just how deadly, how destructive this whole way of living is that I think we just take for granted much of the time. And he's doing it because he wants to show us that the stakes are much higher than we might realize, and he wants to show us a better and more excellent, more positive way to live. So if you've got your sheets there, we're looking at number one now. Greed is like drinking sea water. And there's two ideas in there. Sea water, you know, because it's salty, it doesn't satisfy. It leaves you wanting another drink and another drink. It leaves you wanting more. But also, sea water is deeply destructive to your health. And first of all, Solomon draws our attention to the topic of injustice and oppression. So have you ever had a boss who's put unreasonable or put oppressive demands on his or her co-workers? Perhaps you are that boss. And have you ever wondered why, even in a society where there should be enough to go round, that somehow the poor and the disadvantaged never seem to get a fair deal, never seem to get a fair break? And you might wonder, why is that? Let's look at verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. Solomon says, look, when you see these kind of realities up close, perhaps you've just started in a new workplace or you first start to walk in the corridors of power somewhere, and you see just how dysfunctional and unjust that culture really is up close, the temptation for you is going to be to get disillusioned. Solomon says that the wise person, however, will not be surprised at all. And why not? Look at verse 8. Because they know that the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. And he's saying that, look, once people get in the system, actually it's very hard to live any differently. Each person is under pressure from someone above them to get results, and that one's under pressure from someone above them, and so on. And so it's obvious how a completely dysfunctional culture can spread right the way down through any company or any society. He says, don't be surprised by it. That doesn't mean, however, that there's something inherently wrong with complex hierarchical societies and that he's going to tell us to opt out and all become kind of self-sufficient nomads. No, he says a good leader can also be a real influence for good in such situations. Verse 9, but this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. But the main point is that the wise person will not be surprised by oppression, by injustice. And the deeper reason as to why they're not surprised is because the wise person knows something about the human heart. And that's what the whole of the rest of this section is about. It's about this human tendency that we have to be discontent. This tendency to be chasing after something else that we don't yet have. Look at verse 10, it captures it well. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. It's talking about this unquenchable thirst, like drinking seawater. And it's this coveting, this greed, which then explains the oppression which people experience. If you think about it logically, if somebody has this insatiable appetite for more and more and more, always wanting more toys, more income, more space in the house, whatever it is, then that person will always try to place ever-increasing demands on those on the rung beneath them. Bit by bit, they'll just be cranking up the pressure until eventually the people beneath them end up breaking under the strain. But the main problem with greed in this chapter is especially not what it does to the culture at large, which is very destructive, but it's this special focus here is on what it does to us individually. Not only does it not quench our thirst, we saw that in verse 10, but it also brings a whole load of new problems. And I put those sub-points there on the sheet. The first there, firstly, wealth brings hangers-on and new stress. Look at verse 11. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And this isn't talking just about the lottery winner who suddenly finds that they have an army of distant relatives who just crop up out of the woodwork when their winnings come. But I think it's talking about how even in a normal business, as somebody's business expands, there's a lot more livelihoods, a lot more families depending on your next contract. And coupled with that, more wealth necessarily means more accountant bills, more lawyers, more staff, more managers, more consultants, and so it goes on. And some of you here will know something of that stress. Verse 11, and what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? And this is one of the great ironies of wealth, that those who acquire it are usually the ones who are too busy and too stressed to actually enjoy it. Think about it. Who is it who enjoys the flashiest cars in this world? Do you think it's the executives on the back, you know, still on their conference calls, shouting down the phone? Or do you think it's the chauffeur in the front who's getting to put this new supercar through its paces? The only advantage that the owner gets is that he or she gets to see it in the drive parked at night. That's what verse 11 is saying. All they get to do is see the wealth. They don't get to enjoy it. Verse 12. Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. And this is focusing not so much, I think, on the stress which wealth can bring, as on the self-indulgence. One of the great ironies of our present age is that is the way we pour out money and pain on gym membership, on exercise machines, and all the rest of it. And the whole point of it is to try and undo the effects of the money that we've also poured out on an indulgent lifestyle of overeating and overdrinking. And verse 12 says that the poor laborer has got it much better. They are spared so many of these problems which indulgence brings. And then when nighttime comes, they are the ones sleeping like a baby. By which I don't mean they're up every 3 hours screaming. They're sleeping well. But it's not just that wealth brings hangers-on, it brings stress. Next point, 13, 17, its insecurity also brings misery. Verse 13, there is a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he's father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. Little cameo, little picture of a guy whose riches have spoilt his life twice over. First, in the getting of them, verse 13, that the riches were kept by the owner to his hurt. It was personally costly to amass the riches and to hang on to them. And then they spoilt his life a second time round when he lost them. Because he at the end of it all, he had nothing to show for all this hard work. A wasted life. And the tragedy gets even worse with this guy. Because for the person who loves money, even the loss of their fortune doesn't cause them to abandon this futile approach to life. Look at verse 17. Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. I find that very telling. This guy hasn't learnt, even though he's lost his money. He's annoyed, he's angry. And the point of this section is that we're meant to think, we hear about this guy and we think, well, rather him than me. What a pathetic way to live. You know, these people who are always striving after the next stage and the next stage. And we're meant to think after reading this, I am going to give up on this salt water habit altogether. This is just a mug's game. And instead, I hope by this point, we're thinking, I really got to learn some contentment. That's the most precious thing, the most precious of gifts we could want. And that brings us on to the next point on the sheets. Point two, we're looking at verses 18 to 20. We're to learn contentment. And these next verses have become something of a chorus line or a punchline that keeps recurring in the book of Ecclesiastes. You'll remember we saw it at the end of chapter 2. We're going to see it again at chapter 8, 15. It's like the theme tune of the book. I think we encapsulated it under the slogan, life is about gift more than gain. Do you remember in chapter 2? Let me read, verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. And that word lot there means that these gifts are like our inheritance. They're a specific gift given personally to us from God himself. We're actually introduced to this idea of a lot, an inheritance from God, back in chapter 3, verse 22, in that amazing, the famous chapter, There is a Time for Everything. In that amazing chapter that outlined how God is the great Lord over time. Do you remember? He's the one we can trust. He's the great fresco artist. He's the great playwright. He's the one who has this great enduring, overarching plan for everything that happens in this world. He makes everything beautiful in its time. We learned all that in chapter 3. And it's in trusting this God and discovering that everything which comes our way, including, verse 18, even the toil that we're given to do, but discovering that everything that comes our way is heaven sent. And that is the key to finding real joy and contentment. Discovering that we have a wise and generous Father God who is in charge of every detail of our lives. And I guess there'll be lots of us in this room, if we went around and shared stories, who'll be able to testify what a difference this perspective has made in our lives. Going through life, practicing thankfulness. Remembering daily that whatever we have on our plates right now, that is not random. In fact, there is no such thing as random in this universe. Everything we have is a personal gift from a wise and generous God. It's our lot, we're told here. And even those things which we wish weren't on our plates right now, and we're going to think a lot more about that next week, but we can trust God with them. And we can know that if we belong to him, then he purposes good through those things. He makes everything beautiful in its time. There have actually been three kinds of eating so far in this passage, and I think this summarizes everything so far. Three ways to eat, which one are we going to choose? One kind is in verse 12, and it's indulgent eating, the full stomach of the rich, which gives them indigestion and stops them sleeping. The next kind of eating is in verse 17, and it's angry, bitter eating. Did you see verse 17? The person who eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. So that's the person who's upset because they think they deserve more than they have. So there's the first two, the rich discontented eating, verse 12, or the poor discontented eating, verse 17, or there's the third type of eating, verse 18. So whether rich or poor, there is another way, and this one instead is contented eating. And this, out of all three of them, is the only one who actually gets to really enjoy their food. It could be the same food on all three plates, but only the third eater is really tasting the sweetness of it. It makes me think of You've probably had this experience. I had it even yesterday, of buying children a treat from a ice cream van. And for some children, it's all about maximizing their intake. They work out which is the biggest ice cream they can reasonably ask for, and then ask for two and get a no. Then they wolf it down really quickly, and then they offer... The reason they eat so fast is because they can then offer to help the toddler with their ice cream, which means, as we all know, getting to eat theirs as well. And at the end of it, they're still not quite happy about it because the ice cream wasn't quite the right one, and they didn't... The ice cream van didn't have their favourite, and they're a bit annoyed about that, and they felt that they deserved a bit more than they got. And you contrast that with some other children, and these are children who have grasped that what is going on right now is a real treat. What they are receiving is a loving gift from a parent who is doting and crazy about them. And they say thank you for what they're receiving, whether or not it was quite what they wanted or not, and probably it wasn't, but they trust that their parents were doing them good when the parent chose the treat. And so whatever it is, it tastes sweet in their mouths. In fact, it tastes like love to them, which it is. And that's the point of these three kinds of eating. The point is that as believers, we know that everything we have comes to us from as a personal gift from a heavenly Father who loves us. And so everything we have, even difficult things, can taste sweeter to us as we learn this kind of thankful contentment in our lives. Now, the final two points go on to reinforce what we've already covered, basically. And Solomon explains that without this kind of contentment, life is miserable. That's point three. And finally, that the wise will accept this. So let's look at these last two points on the sheet. Without this contentment, life will be miserable. Chapter 6, verse 1, "There is an evil I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires." Do you get the picture? Here's the guy who has everything. But there's one thing missing, verse 2. "Yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them." This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. So did you get it? Verse 2, what this person lacks is the power to enjoy God's gifts. And actually, that's exactly what the person who has learned contentment does have. Back in chapter 5, 19, do you remember he was described as the one to whom God has given wealth and possessions and, 5:19, power to enjoy them. Did you see the point? This is a contrast between two types of people. On the one hand, there's the person at the beginning of chapter 6 who can enjoy, afford the finest restaurants. They get the best chefs in the world to prepare exquisite delicacies for them every night. And yet it's all a waste of time because it's as if they have no taste buds. Whatever or wherever they eat, it's as if they're shoveling in cold grey sludge. This person has everything, but they just lack one thing. What chapter 6 verse 2 calls the power to enjoy the gifts of God. And this situation is described as a grievous evil. It's terrible. Contrast that person now with the one at the end of chapter 5, the God-infused, contented person, the person in chapter 5, 19. This person, on the other hand, wherever they eat, perhaps even, you know, they're just getting a snack from the fast food van on the corner, but wherever they eat, there is something to enjoy on their plates. They've seen the good in it. And Solomon wants us to step back and say, is it just possible that in life we are envying the wrong people? Is it just possible? Well, he says, come with me and flick through Forbes billionaires list or the Sunday Times rich list. And I will show you some of the most miserable people on the planet. And of course, this guy Solomon had dined with all of them. He moved amongst the dignitaries, the royalty and the elite amongst the world. And Solomon says, look, it's one thing having the largest pile of You might have to translate this for your own taste, but imagine you had the largest possible pile of ambrosia custard tins. What could be better? But what is that enormous mountain of cans? Makes your mouth drool, doesn't it? What is that enormous mountain of cans worth if, and I should have my prop, but I forgot it. What's it worth if we don't have a can opener to go with it? And Solomon wants us to see that all wealth, all possessions are completely worthless unless we're learning to trust God and find true contentment. That's what the can opener is. Otherwise, what good? I mean, it doesn't matter if there's a million or a billion, however big the pile is, it's completely worthless. And Solomon pushes this point home in verses 3 to 6. Two of the classic marks of blessing in the ancient world were having a very big family and living a very long life and having an honored death. And so Solomon takes us to the ancient equivalent of the Forbes billionaires, and he says this, verse 3, if a man fathers, this is kind of a comic book caricature, 100 children and lives many years so that the days of his years are many. So you kind of get the emphasis here. The guy who's got it all, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial. So he died as he lived, greedy and lonely. I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. He's saying, what use is a long life and 100 children if there is no contentment? The result is only a frustrated life and a lonely death. Even a stillborn child with no descendants, no name even, will be better off than him. And in any case, verse 6, do not all go to the one place. Both lives will end in death anyway. No ultimate gain. It's just a matter of timing. So what's the good of any of it without contentment? Now, according to the Guinness Book of Records, in 1966, Jean-Paul Getty was the world's richest man, and predictably he had literally billions to his name. He lived in a 72-room Tudor mansion near Guildford. He had an enormous art collection. He had numerous palaces and castles dotted all around the world. And yet, like so many, he never felt he had enough. It was an earlier world's richest man, John Rockefeller, who was asked how much money is enough, and he responded very honestly, just a little bit more. And it's kind of funny if it wasn't so tragic. And famously, Jean-Paul Getty, installed a coin-operated telephone at his Guildford mansion, where even guests would be expected to pay for their own phone calls so that he could recoup some of his hospitality costs. And a recent biography said of him, his is the story of a wealth that afforded him no joy. That's what verse 2 is all about. All the cans, imagine it, you know, a million ambrosia custard cans, and yet the one thing he lacked was that can opener. And the biographer goes on, 5 marriages, 5 divorces, 2 terrible deaths, an unforgiving, unrelenting miserliness. He was a legend of luxury, lust, and loneliness. Now, of course, these guys like John Rockefeller, Jean-Paul Getty, they are extreme examples. But Solomon, he wants us to use these kind of extreme examples, like the one in verses 3 to 6 with 100 children and so on. He wants the extreme examples to lodge in our minds so that we start asking the question, who is it we are really envying in this world? What is the life that we really long to pursue? Do we really think that going after the next thing and the next thing, the better job, the bigger house, amassing a billion of ambrosia custard tins with no can opener. Do we really think that is what life is all about? And Solomon concludes this section by challenging us that the wise will accept this. Look at verse 7. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? So he's asking, what's the real benefit of godly wisdom in this life? And here's his answer in proverb form, as we've come to expect from Solomon, verse 9. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. There it is. And that phrase, the sight of the eyes, is about the ability to see the good in what's in front of us. And you can follow that up if you check out the footnote on verse 6. That's the sense of this sight of the eyes. And so verses 8 to 9 are saying that whilst wisdom doesn't fix everything in this world, one massive advantage of wisdom is that the wise person is the one who learns contentment. They learn to see the good in what's in front of them, rather than letting their appetite always wander after something else. So there's these two options in verse 9, the sight of the eyes or the wandering of the appetite. And the natural question is, which of these are we training ourselves in? Which of these are we training our children in? So the foolish person trains their appetite to wander. And if you want to get into it, it's very, very easy. And there's a whole industry designed to help us in this. There's glossy magazines, catalogues, there's websites, all designed to help us to drool over the lifestyle that's just out of our reach, or the partner we might want, or the new purchase that we just might want, or the erotic fantasy that we might want. It's all there on offer. So if we want to, we can train our eyes to wander into discontent. And that's the fool's path. Or will we train our eyes to see the good in things, to remember in everything our wise and generous Father, and to practice a spirit of continuous thankfulness? There are some church traditions where when you ask someone how they are, they automatically reply, instead of, I don't know how you reply, fine, I'm okay, the automatic reply is highly blessed, something like that. And clearly anything can become just a cliche. I certainly don't want us to kind of become unreal about our lives or unable to share our struggles. But there's something very healthy about that. Does it even occur to us when someone asks how we are to share something that we're thankful about, to share God's goodness with them? Or would somebody say about us that our joy in the Lord is so deep that no one's ever seen it surface? What are we training ourselves in? Is it the wandering or is it the thankfulness? Now, Solomon knows that what he is saying in this section is so countercultural, counterhuman possibly, certainly counterfallen human, that it's likely, he thinks, to be ignored and dismissed by his hearers. Perhaps you're thinking this right now. You're thinking, well, this sounds very trite and naive, but it's not real-world thinking. And his final plea is that we see the stupidity of fighting against God and his wisdom on this topic. Verse 10, whatever has come to be has already been named, and it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. He's saying, please do not think that you can fight against the sovereign God on this one. Verse 11, the more words, the more vanity. And what is the advantage to man? All the clever arguments in the world will not change this reality. Please don't think you know better, Solomon says. There's a famous transcript of a radio conversation between some Americans on a US naval ship and some Canadians, and it's dated back from October 95. You might have heard it, and it goes like this. The Americans say, please divert your course 15 degrees to the north to avoid a collision. The Canadians respond, recommend you divert your course 15 degrees to the south to avoid a collision. Americans. This is the aircraft carrier USS Lincoln, the second largest ship in the US Atlantic fleet. I demand that you change your course 15 degrees north. Canadians, this is a lighthouse, your call. Now, clearly, this is a kind of, the story is a cheap way for Canadians to make fun of Americans, and I get that. But the other point of the story is to show the absolute foolishness of pride and of thinking that we can know better than God and thinking that we can make reality fit around us and our demands. And Solomon wants to press home on us here that arguing with God, whose ways are fixed, like that lighthouse is fixed on the rock, arguing with God will only end in tears and disaster. He wants us to get it straight in our heads. Now, you'll know if you've been with us through the series, every time we look at Ecclesiastes, we are interested in what happens to these truths when they're passed through the prism of Jesus Christ and the gospel in the New Testament. And the place in the New Testament which seems to draw on this passage most directly, I think, is 1 Timothy 6. That was our other reading. It's also on your sheets. And in that passage, Paul makes similar warnings about the stupidity and the dangers of greed. Have a look again, 1 Timothy 6 on your sheets. Now, there is great gain. You'll recognize a good Ecclesiastes word, gain. There is great gain in godliness with contentment. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. And the writer here, Paul, he seems to be drawing directly from verses like Ecclesiastes 5:15 there. But, he says, verse 8, if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. And that's the big message of that Ecclesiastes chapter we've just been looking at. But as is typical in the New Testament, everything here is ratcheted up a notch. Because here in the New Testament, it's made explicit that what's really at stake for the person whose life is governed by grasping the next thing and the next thing is not just a wasted and miserable life, but a wasted and miserable eternity. Look at verse 9. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. And what kind of ruin and destruction does he have in mind? Verse 10, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Please do not ignore this warning. Please do not think you can argue with a lighthouse. You see, in the Lord Jesus, we have even stronger reason to trust God's wisdom and his goodness. Think about it. In the cross of the Lord Jesus, we see how God uses even the worst of circumstances to bring about the most beautiful ends. We really can trust the Lord. But of course, if we refuse to trust him, if we carry on indulging in this salt water habit, then this kind of foolishness will only end in tears, eternally.